up, everybody? Welcome back to Under the Microscope, where we dissect the art of basketball. I'm Coleman from By Any Means Basketball.
And I'm Yosef from Value Basketball Skills Training.
So I know we've been lacking on the guest episodes. I think we've only had, like 4 or 5 max? Mm-hmm. So we definitely got to get that going. But today, we got my man Ty with us. We're pretty much going to just have a conversation about what we've been doing recently in our own training. Just kind of let that spark some conversation. So it's going to end up completely in other directions that we probably never thought it would go, which is the fun part about it. We definitely want to have more guys on here to come and just talk hoops. So Ty, if you want to just introduce yourself, give the listeners just kind of a background, who you are, what you do, a little bit about the facility you just opened pretty recently, and then we can get into it from there.
Yeah, so my name is Tyler. I am the owner of TJL Training, and I recently just opened my own basketball training facility out in Lowell, Mass. So been doing this. My story is honestly kind of like Coleman's. Went to school for 1 year, and then I decided to leave, and I started training kind of in high school like he did.
Yeah.
Really just kind of fell in love with it and decided that's kind of like what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So I just kind of dove head first into that and then been training ever since. And then just recently opened up my own training facility out in Lowell, Massachusetts. So
that's awesome, man.
Hell yeah. Yeah. So I went up there to Lowell to do a 3-day clinic. Mm-hmm. Had a lot of guys in there, and it was good linking up there. And it was also cool to see that, like, especially in a world where the training culture is becoming a little bit diluted, you know, a lot of our ideas on training kind of align. So that's cool. And then also a lot of my ideas with Yosef align. So therefore, I guess you can consider all of us to be like pretty on the same page in terms of how we train basketball players as a whole. So definitely expecting it to be a good conversation. So anybody want to start off just with something they've been implementing recently or playing around with in a session recently, and kind of let that spark a conversation?
Tyler, do you have anything you want to start with? Or
I could start. So one of the things that I've been experimenting with, and I kind of saw Coleman post about last week, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, was just kind of experimenting with like teaching players to essentially move without the basketball, and like translating that into handling the basketball. So like, obviously that ball is just an extension to your hand, and you have to be able to move first. If you can't move, it doesn't matter how good you can dribble stationary, because it's not gonna translate over into game. So I've been working on a lot of things where players are just kind of going up against each other. They have to essentially like just juke a player out, or they have to just learn how to change speeds, go from fast to slow, things like that, making cuts, being shifty, kind of using their shoulders and shifting their body side to side, and kind of just playing with a lot of drills like that to just teach players movement, as opposed to just having players standing still and just pounding the shit out of the ball in the same spot, because obviously that's not how the game of basketball is played.
Yeah.
And then basically what he's referring to in terms of what I posted about, it was a quick story post, I believe. And it was basically saying like movement is king in terms of handling the basketball, which a lot of people honestly had a problem with. Well, not a lot of people, but here and there people kind of showed their disagreement. But at the same time, like you said, the basketball is simply an extension of our hands. If we can't move, if we can't get past the defender without the ball, we definitely can't do it with the ball. So a lot of the times, also in training, a lot of the time, the ball is essentially a limiting factor, because let's say we're working on changing speeds and we can't hang the ball long enough to, but at the same time, if we're able to rep that out without a basketball, that could teach us to move in ways that we can apply in other situations, other contexts. So sometimes I do feel like we need to separate the movement and the ball handling. And that's where a lot of that, literally just taking the ball out of players' hands and teaching them the movement first, and then adding in the component that is the ball control. I think that could be huge. And I honestly don't see many trainers at all doing it, which is expected because it's a very unique method, and it definitely requires some buy-in from players. Because if you got guys coming in and they're doing stuff without a basketball for the first 10, 15 minutes, or even the first 5 minutes, that requires them trusting you to be like, all right, this guy knows what he's doing to the point where I can be without a basketball in my hands and still get some good work in and understand why this is working. But at the same time, there's a lot of stuff that we can do with this.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, so one thing I really like about that is just how it could be used as like a corrective measure as well. So if you're trying to like develop a, if a player really is having a lot of trouble just grasping a specific movement or a specific footwork or whatever, taking the ball out of the hands completely altogether just makes that movement so much easier to learn. Right. And then another thing I kind of like as an extension to that, which was what I was kind of what I was about to mention earlier, is being more lenient with the carrying rules. So recently I've been playing around with this the seesaw hezzy move I just posted but last week, and then one thing I got a lot of comments about is about how this guy just kept carrying the ball in the videos because he was still trying to develop that move in the first place. So being more lenient with the carrying out has helped tremendously with that, because they focus more on the body movement, and then when they get the body movement down, it's easier to switch that focus to the hand placement and correct that carrying.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think like there's some like parents of kids I train, and like I'm trying to teach them a certain footwork, and they see them carry and they're so worried about the carry, and it's like, look, I'm more worried about the movement here. Like if they can't, they're going to be so constrained by the fact that they don't want to carry the ball that they're not going to move properly.
Exactly.
Like, let's just get them to move right, and then we can kind of take away that carry later, and that's really easy to fix. But the movement part, that's harder to fix. So if you're only worried about the carry, and they can't worry about both things at the same time.
Exactly.
So you got to pick one or the other. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I know. And I think that we were talking about this earlier too, and that's just exposing players to more movements, essentially building up a movement bank. And it's something that there's only so much you can do with the ball in your hands, in terms of your footwork, in terms of how you're moving. And the more that we can take the ball out of players' hands and expose them to different movements that may feel awkward, like we were talking about earlier, if we can make as much stuff feel normal, as much awkward stuff feel normal as possible, that's good for us, because basketball is such an unpredictable game, and we could get a situation thrown at us that we've never seen before, and we're going to have to pull something essentially new out of the bag. And if we're not exposed to that footwork and our training, it's going to be completely new for us. And I'm definitely going to talk more about this in the future, just like on Instagram, whatever. But there's only so much we can do with the ball to expose ourselves to these movements. So I do think there is a way, or a valuable spot in our training to take out the ball. And that's like, again, like I said, it takes buy-in, but I think it's definitely valuable.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
Yosef, anything you've been implementing lately?
Yeah. One thing I've actually been trying to implement is something new with my training style. So when I've done some reflecting on some of the training I've done, I've noticed that sometimes I could be a little bit more, like over explaining some things. So I've been trying to recently just completely like just demonstrate something one time and just let the player ask the questions if necessary. And then if I feel like they're still not doing something as correctly as I would want them to do, instead of trying to explain it to them again, I would ask them how they think they could have done it better, so they can get their input and their buy-in as well. So I think just being less of a, like the less preachy, I guess, but more involving them in the process of getting them to figure out what's wrong is key, just because they have to be the first ones to understand they're making the mistake first in order to even see the need to make the correction. So
And Ty, I noticed this is something that you're really good at, just speaking less, and it seems like something you've kind of figured out, which is, you know, honestly, I forget who we were talking about earlier who said like the less they talk the better. Damn, I can't remember who we're talking about, but either way, the message kind of stays like the less we're talking, I think the better, because the more we let players self-organize, focus on external cues we give them, the better. And that's why I've been trying to, just like you, Yosef, I've been trying to implement a question into every demonstration that I give. Yeah. So maybe I'll give them the what move we're doing, and then ask them, okay, why are we doing this? Mm-hmm. Or maybe I'll give them the why, and then say, how are we going to solve this situation? And I think that one keeps guys engaged. A lot of younger players are there just to go through the drills, go through the motions, which is okay. They're younger. I get it. They're there to get a sweat in, get some work in, whatever. But that keeps them engaged. And two, it helps them figure out stuff on their own without us just wrapping our asses off, which is
exactly
which is huge. Because I definitely have looked at some footage of myself in the past, especially like last year, and I'd be like, damn, bro, just stop talking. Like, shut up. But it's something I've definitely gotten better at, and I continue to emphasize to myself whenever I go into a session.
Yeah, that's we're all guilty of that at times.
Yeah,
but,
Yeah,
and then you catch yourself and you try to correct. But like,
yeah,
it's funny because like in that book, that Language of Coaching book, Coleman, that you were reading as well, it was like they're talking about how like you explain something to an athlete in such depth, and then it's like, all right, so what do you want me to do? It's kind of like that when you're like what I've really been, especially from taking away from that book, is like sometimes I'll try to explain a whole move to somebody and they'll basically just be like, all right, what do you want me to do? So basically I just kind of like, I'm just going to show them the move. And then kind of like Yosef said, like, then if they don't know what to do, then I might explain it. But exactly. Like, I'm just going to show it first. There's no need to put in words unless I have to. So if a player can understand it with less words, the better, because that's going to take up less fucking brain space, right? So it's going to be easier for them to repeat. The more complex I make it, the harder it's going to be for them to repeat it. And then the other thing, kind of like you were saying, adding questions. One thing that I really do a lot of times is have the players teach me. So like that really gets them engaged, because if I ask them, all right, teach me it, and they're not paying attention, they're going to be completely lost. But one of the books I read about skill acquisition talks about like teaching someone something is one of the best ways to learn something. Yeah. So if you can get your player to teach you something, or even when I'm having a group, I like, okay, this person, I want you to teach that person. I'm not going to say a word. That person has to teach him. So like now they're working together and that person's teaching them. So that's not only facilitating their learning, but then it's also like, all right, they're helping somebody else too. And I can kind of just sit there and watch them, see how they learn, see how they're interacting, things like that.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's good stuff. And I remember the same book, the Language of Coaching book, they mentioned that, and this is something I see a lot in trainers, is you shouldn't, unless it's a very simple cue, we shouldn't be cueing guys or girls during their movement. So, and I'm guilty of this, as you know, everyone's guilty of this at times, where someone will be doing a move and we're telling them what to do as they're doing it. And it makes it even worse when it's an internal cue, which is probably beyond the scope of this episode. But if we're telling guys what to do as they're doing it, that's creating a very robotic sense for them. Like they're hearing that guidance, and it's going to throw them off, because paralysis by analysis, they're thinking too much. That's going to get them in a game thinking too much once again. And that's where they get that kind of hesitancy in a game where, you know, they turn into a practice player. So learning to say less before the rep, during the rep, and even after the rep. I don't think we always need to be correcting players when they mess up, because a lot of the times I'll try to do it. Like, let's say a player, I give him a move. He tries it out. After I try to correct it, most of the time he's like, yeah, I felt it. I got it. And he'll correct it himself. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something to be said for just letting players fuck up, come back to the top, go again, mess up maybe again. And eventually they're just going to figure it out, because our body is very, very good at self-organizing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And one of the other books I was reading, I forget, I think it was called Skill Acquisition in Sport or whatever, it was saying like when you finish, when a player finishes a rep, a lot of times there's like kind of a grace period where they're kind of seeing, okay, how did my body feel? Did I do that right? So like if you kind of correct them immediately after the rep, it doesn't give them enough time to like kind of give themselves feedback.
Interesting.
So like right after the rep, don't always be like, oh no, or as soon as they mess up, don't say anything right away. Kind of give them a little bit of time, or sometimes they'll be like, okay, do you think you did that right? How did that feel?
Yeah.
And then they'll kind of be like, oh, I kind of felt awkward. And I'll be like, all right, try to make it better. and then see if they kind of self-correct. If they don't self-correct, then that's where I kind of come in and kind of give them more detail and kind of correct from there.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't always have to be like, no, bring your left foot here or shoot your hip this way. It's more so like telling them an objective and letting them find out the best way to get there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I would say one thing that I'm interested to hear you guys' thoughts on, and I know we're all kind of on the same page on this, but I'm implementing more, well, one is more detailed focuses in workouts, or like not detailed, but more specific focuses. Like, I would say the last month or two of group workouts, every workout has been a focus that's something that players can really identify. And it's not like a bunch of different options, like creating contact in a certain situation or a certain type of read off the screens. And a lot of our programs really focus on this, Yosef. So I know like we're definitely on the page, and Ty, we've talked about this. But also just implementing progressions into it. And I know you posted today about this with the curl progression, which was, you know, essentially the same way I've been structuring stuff. So I want to hear your guys' take as to why it's so important to implement these kind of progressions into workouts, starting from like the most simple stuff and building up to integrating it into more game situation like stuff.
I think it's really good to just kind of build that player's confidence with that new learning objective, just because as they get smaller wins where they win, they get the simplest progression, and then they get that
psychological momentum.
Exactly. Then they're like, okay, let me make it a little bit more complex, add this movement, and then it gives them that comfortability to learn that move at their own pace. And because they might just breeze right through the first three steps, but then the fourth step might stump them, but then 5, 6, and 7 are really easy. So it just kind of breaks it down for them into chunks, like we've talked about earlier in the podcast previously. But I think it's just really good and really necessary, especially when learning new movements.
Yeah.
I think for the progressions, number one, obviously, it's just like efficient for like acquiring that skill and actually being able to apply it into games. But I think like with the progressions, it's big because if you were trying to throw them into, say there's a 5-part progression, right? You throw them into step 5. There's so many different parts that they have to think about that it's so hard to perform the rep correctly. Yeah. So if you like, all right, let's start with step 1, then they get step 1, they don't have to think about it as much. So then you build on that. Okay, they don't have to think about step 1 or 2 as much. They can focus on 3. So it's a little bit easier for them to process it. And then I think like what also the language of coaching was talking about was like in terms of like game transfer, starting from like a block type practice and then getting to more varied. So that's like what I do with a lot of my progressions is like, okay, it starts pretty block practice, very repetitive. And then it gets to kind of more live kind of repetitions where you have to like make a read, or you have to either use this option or this option. And then, but if you were to try to throw them in that situation right off the bat, they're not going to know what to do. They're going to be thinking too much. So just kind of taking them through that progressions just makes it a little bit easier, like fully acquiring that skill and being able to transfer it over.
Yeah. And I think something that I've been trying to do every single workout is end with a live version of what we've been working on, or a live version of something, whether it's 1-on-1, 2-on-2, 3-on-3, hell, even 5-on-5, which is rare, but generally 1-on-1, some way where players are guided into using what we just worked on. And I'm not telling them, okay, you have to do this, but I'm putting them in a situation where it would work pretty well if they applied everything that we just did. And I think that live part at the end, one, again, builds buy-in from players. They love playing live. 2, helps turn it to instinct. And 3, teaches them that this shit works.
Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%.
So one thing that just crossed my mind, one question, and we can talk about this pretty quickly and you guys can get into other stuff. And this is kind of random because it's not really related to what we're just talking about. But one of the players that I'm working with, just because we're talking about stuff that we've been doing recently, he broke his finger on his right hand. So he has a cast on it. And we're going solely left-hand workouts So what, how would you guys, I want to hear before I say what I've been doing. I've been trying to get creative with it, but how would you guys approach this situation?
Well, it'd be a lot of ball handling for sure. A lot of moving ball handling with just getting creative, finding ways to just dribble with the left hand mainly. A lot of touch finishing. Definitely no shooting just because that right hand's not going to be really in shape to be shooting. Yeah. So a lot of just touch, getting the touch feel for the ball down really solidified. And then primarily that was still a smaller focus on moving with the ball. Yeah. As, like leaning towards that left hand.
Yeah. I mean, I would do like all the basic kind of stuff, like weekend dribbling, finishing, all that stuff, but definitely a lot more. It depends on like the level of the player, obviously, and what they know, but kind of like we were talking about earlier, is doing stuff where they don't have the ball in the hand. A lot of movement, a lot of footwork kind of stuff. And then one thing would just be like have them do some visualization stuff where they're actually using their hand visually. They're not actually using it, but kind of just visualizing. And that's kind of a form of practice, even when they can't use that right hand. I feel like that can kind of just help just keep that skill kind of there. And then, like I said, just a lot of movement stuff and just teach them a lot more, like, and you can also do stuff off the ball too, just like learning how to cut, learning how to set screens, cut, like all that kind of stuff like that, that players wouldn't really be able to do as much or wouldn't want to do as much if they could use their strong hand.
Yeah. No, I think it's, I was going to add that as well. I think it's one, it's tough because it's in season. And he was literally just killing it, like one of the top national tournaments. Last game breaks his one of the fingers on his right hand, but he's coming back in 2 weeks. So it's almost like I'm looking at it and I'm trying to convince him to look at it as like an opportunity to work on stuff that we wouldn't work on otherwise. Mm-hmm. So like you said, if I were to say, all right, we're going to go 30 minutes with no basketball today, and he had both hands, he'll be like, dude, what the hell are we doing?
Yeah.
But now it's like, all right, we got to fill up the time somehow. How many in and outs and like left hand finishes can we do? So now is the time. And it's like I figured out this happened literally right after I posted about and started thinking about like this relationship between the ball and movement and figuring out ways to implement drills with no ball. So this happened at the perfect time. So a lot of that I'm trying to get creative with. And then also definitely finding ways to condition, which sucks, but like 2 weeks off during the season, that can get you. And then he's heading right back to a tournament. So like this, and this is like, this is where it's fun to like be a coach, and it's like an art now. It's not like the science where everything's like, we can really systemize everything, and like everything's very like calculated. Now it's like, all right, what can we do here? What can we do there to fill in the gaps, to make sure he stays up to like tuned up? And it's fun, but it's also a challenge. And I think the more of these type situations that we get as coaches, the better for the future, because all of us are very young. So learning to embrace these situations, I think is huge.
Yeah, that's a great opportunity. Just any type of player that you interact with, where it's like you've kind of faced a challenge, whether it's you've seen something that you haven't seen before, and it's like those are the best opportunities for growth, because it makes you wonder, it makes you curious, it makes you find new solutions, which obviously grows you as a trainer. So
yeah
I was about to say the same thing. It just challenges you to get more creative with your training, and if it's not necessarily like an injury they have to overcome, it's probably like a shooting slump or some issues that they're having on the court with IQ. Is just an interesting way. You know, you have to specialize and focus on whatever that weakness is in a creative way to kind of tackle it.
Hell yeah. All right, you guys have anything? I'm thinking we'll get a few more minutes just about like stuff that we've been implementing lately. And then Ty, I'll kind of ask you about like the business side of how you opened up your own facility essentially. So for any coaches, mm-hmm. listening, they can kind of get the last few minutes of that and understand the steps of that. But is there anything else that you guys have been focusing on, trying out lately, experimenting with, whatever?
I'd say one thing, which Coleman, me and you kind of talked about it when you were down here, was like guided discovery, essentially. Yep. So like if I want to teach, say, a player a hezzy, right, if I was to just try to explain it to them and pound it through their head, they're probably not going to learn it. But if I can kind of create a situation where I'm guiding them to learn how to do this without them even being aware of it, kind of like implicit learning, essentially, where they don't even know they're learning it yet, but they're doing it, right? And then you can be like, point out, look, you're already doing this. You can kind of take a video and show them, like, this is what you're doing right now. And they'll be like, oh, shit, like, I didn't know I could do that. So, like, just figuring out certain situations where, like, I can get a player to do something without them even thinking about it, whether it's a new skill or practicing a skill that they already have down and try to get it better. Just kind of playing around with that, figuring out different situations to just guide them to learn new things.
Yeah. No, yeah. I think players are more capable than what they think they are, physically at least. And what's holding them back is, I don't want to say closed-mindedness, but almost closed-mindedness in that, like, they're cutting themselves short of what they can do because they're trying to think too much. And that goes back to, and this, again, a lot of stuff relates back to that internal versus external cues, which is essentially, if you guys are hearing this, you're like, what the hell is an internal external cue? It's partly because I've been reading a lot about them lately, but internal is basically saying, like, focus on a body part. So move your foot this way, lift your shoulder this way. External is more objective based. So get on balance, or like analogies, like we were talking about earlier. So that's the difference there. It's a huge difference. External has like a lot of research behind it in terms of being the superior type. So even this is like, if we tell a player, if we're teaching them a move and we give them an analogy, and I'm sure you have an example of this that you used recently. We give them an analogy, or we tell them something simple, but it's more objective based. Like, this is kind of I'll make this short, but it's a story from the other day. I literally wanted players to come to a 2-foot hop and then push out of it for a 1-dribble pull up. Literally the most simple thing I've taught in months. Like, 2 feet come down at the same time and you get out of it. Like, players were coming down left, right. They couldn't get their feet to come down at the same time. So literally all I said was, make one sound with your feet. It shouldn't be 1-2. It should be one sound with your feet. Immediately just started clicking. And I'm sure, I don't remember, but I'm sure before that I was saying with your feet, hence the word feet, like that's the big thing there. Make sure your feet come down at the same time. And then as soon as I say, make one sound with the ground, boom, they get it. And even stuff like that, like, they probably didn't think they were capable of making something that simple, really be that simple. But as soon as I said something that was easy and in an external cue, they got it. Which is crazy. And like, analogies, all that stuff is just, it's so valuable in terms of teaching guys without having to say much.
Yeah. I actually had a similar story with that. I was trying to teach somebody like a pull-up shot fake hezzy. And then, so what I did initially is just, I would get them to line up and kind of just go through just 1-dribble pull-ups, repeated 1-dribble pull-ups. And I would just kind of emphasize, make sure you guys are paying attention to every little detail that you guys are doing. And then, because that's what's going to be useful for you guys to learn the shot fake hezzy later. Because after that, when I had them do the, now I said, now we're going to go into a shot fake hezzy, they went 1-dribble, and then they got into what they thought looked like a shot fake hezzy, and it was just completely different from how they originally get into their shot. And it was just crazy because I was just telling them, do the same motion you went while you were shooting. And then when they actually switched the objective to doing the shot fake hezzy instead of reacting and getting out of it in a reactive way, it just wasn't clicking in their heads anymore. So then when I introduced the fact that I was like, all right, just go into it as if you're about to pick it up and actually get into your pull-up, and then still they wouldn't pick it up that way, so I had to actually play defense on them and make them react to me being there in that closeout space for them to actually be able to get the shot fake hezzy down in that position. So it was
is an external cue.
Yeah, again. Exactly. External cue coming to play.
Yep. No, it's crazy. What was I gonna say? Oh yeah, no. I was gonna ask Tyler, do you have any analogies off the top of your head? Because I know we were talking about that earlier, like creating a full document of just like analogies, external cues, that we use commonly. Do you have any that would be a good example?
I'd say one that I've used was like, so when players are getting into their pick up off the dribble. They have the tendency to try to pick up too early.
Yeah.
So like I was working on kids ripping one dribble pull up, very, very simple task. Yeah. Obviously, but like kids want to pick up super early. And if you're just like, oh, yeah, pick up later, or bring your hand to the ball later, that's obviously internal. So I was just like, all right, before, as you rip, once you rip, reach into your pocket almost with that left hand and then bring your hand to the ball.
Mm.
So I was just like, all right, reach into your pocket. So they'd bring their hand to their hip. And then as that, so that it really just fixed their like dribble timing and how they picked up the ball. And it just immediately, as I said, it worked every single time. Yeah. So I was just like, reach into your pocket. Like something simple as that just literally works so easily.
And it's like we mentioned this earlier when we were on the phone, that if you just come in and you're a bystander and you're just watching, you're not going to see any difference between that and internal cueing. Like another coach could be saying, or hell, even one of us could be saying, like, bring your hand to it later. And then one of us could be saying, reach in your pocket. The bystander is not going to notice a difference, but they don't know how important the variation of that cue is.
Yeah.
And that's the crazy thing of how powerful language is. And it's simple language. It's really simple language, but learning how to manipulate words and even just like objects. Like I know Yosef with the same concept of delaying that pickup, we use chairs. Like you have to touch the chair before you get into it. And we've done a ton of stuff with that. And it's really just finding simple ways to manipulate stuff can be huge, and it can really make or break a player, because and then that builds that subconscious skill set rather than having to think about your hand every time or your arm every time.
Absolutely.
So we'll give it like 5-10 minutes. Tyler, if you want to talk a little bit about let's just say you're giving some advice to a guy who wants to open up, or I would say a guy or girl who wants to open up a training facility, especially at such a young age, what were some general steps? Obviously you don't have to give away the whole secret sauce and whole nine, but some general steps to how you got that done, because I know it was definitely a process.
So the first like main step is obviously like trying to secure financing, whether that's you saving every dime you can, or just having financing available, whether that's a loan. So for me, that was just, I knew I wanted to have a gym down the road. I knew it was going to take money, and I didn't want to have to go outside to like get a loan and kind of have to rely on that. So I was like, all right, I'm going to just save as much as I can. So I saved literally everything from the last couple of years. And then when that opportunity came, I was ready. I had the money. I didn't have to worry, and I can just act on it, because I knew, all right, if my goal is to have a gym, and that time comes and I don't have the money and I don't have, and I'm not ready to do it, then I'm going to be really, really pissed. So that was really my main focus. And then obviously you have to have a clientele or a solid business to be able to do that.
Yeah.
So obviously I had to just, like, I was even right before, because obviously the whole quarantine thing, training outside, I'm driving from town to town, like 6 different towns in one day, training outside in the sun. So like, just grinding those sessions out, and over the years, just trying to build up that clientele and just giving as much value as I can. And that was just always the main thing for me, you know, give more than you get. So that was the main two things that allowed me to do that. Because if I didn't grind the days I didn't want to do sessions, or I didn't drive an hour when I didn't want to, or do all like, or go to a camp when I wasn't getting paid that much, but I knew it was going to grow my clientele. If I didn't do that stuff, I wouldn't have had the clientele or the business structure to be able to open my own gym, because it wouldn't have sustained. And if I didn't save all that money and have that goal in my head the whole time, it would have been extremely, extremely tough. So I'd say those are the two like main points. Obviously there's a lot of small details in there, but without those things, the gym's not even possible. So
yeah, mm-hmm. Not 100%. I think this is a really good episode for coaches to listen to. Obviously players, especially the first part of it, just how we can manipulate our workouts to really give us the best results, but especially for coaches, everything from using language in the optimized way, to structuring workouts the best, to even down the line opening a facility. I think it's been a really good episode for trainers, for sure, coaches. So appreciate you for hopping on here. I know it's late and we got early mornings, but if you guys got anything else you want to address, let me know. But I think we definitely knocked out a lot.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, awesome to meet you, Tyler.
Yeah, nice to meet you too, bro.
So yeah, appreciate you guys for tuning in. Appreciate both of you guys for being willing to do this somewhat late at night. If you guys got any questions for us or stuff that you want to see on the next episodes, let us know. Most of our topics actually come from you guys' suggestions. So definitely let us know. Try to get to them. I know it's been a while since we posted a podcast. It's been like 2, maybe 3 weeks, which is crazy. But definitely been packed up now that gyms are starting to open up a little bit and the season's kind of uncertain. So had a lot of clients, but we're getting back to it now. So let us know anything. And thanks for tuning in.